Salutations, sultry Stargate spectators. Bastion here, bringing you an all-new episode 5 of the Stargate Fancast, Atlantis Edition. This week, we will talk about some news, the latest episode of Atlantis, Dr. Rodney McKay, and what handheld weapons are in the Pegasus Galaxy. I'm trying to change things up a bit, so I won't be doing verses for a little bit. And maybe if people like that section, they'll actually email and ask me to bring it back. But nobody's been responding to what I have to say, so we'll talk about that later. But I do know that I have listeners out there, because from July 16th to today, I've used a gigabyte of bandwidth on my server. Not a lot, but hey, you know, for only having 4 episodes out there, it's quite a bit. So I do know that you're out there. I just need to find a way to see if you're alive and kicking. On a different note, my co-host, Leon, is on vacation this week, so he won't be doing the other episode of Stargate Fancast. But good news is, he will be back next week, and he's going to make up for lost time by covering both Episodes 2 and Episodes 3 of Stargate SG-1. So stay tuned for that. And I just wanted to make a side note on the last episode I did, Episode 4, of the SG Fancast. I just want to apologize for how crappy and unprofessional it was. It was really sloppy of me, and I'm quite ashamed of myself for even putting it out there, but I was in a rush, and so I hope you guys didn't forgive me. But I don't plan on any of that crap happening anymore, so we're moving on from that point, and that's done, so let's move on. But like I said, we have a lot of stuff to cover this week, and get ready for the best episode 5 you'll ever listen to. On with the show, and now for news.
Incoming wormhole!
Not Nearly Neat is a new world of news. This week in Stargate news has been very exciting for many Stargate fans. The biggest news in the past week, well, mainly kind of a rumor, for this hasn't really been confirmed yet, but it's damn well close to being a done deal, is that Dean Devlin, the godfather of Stargate, has been in communication with MGM to complete the trilogy he tried to start with the original Stargate movie. With Stargate SG-1 nearing its lifespan, MGM is looking for new ways to revitalize the franchise, and Devlin believes that such a way to do that is to finish what he started. Devlin said that the movies would not be closely related to SG-1, but rather continue the original Stargate movie by picking up 12 years after the original movie ended, with Jackson being left on Abydos and O'Neill coming back to Earth, and it picks up 12 years after that. The movie would not interfere with the canon of the show, but rather it would be, I don't know how we'd work it, but he says that the two timelines can coexist peacefully. Personally, I never realized that the movie was supposed to have any sequels, and I would really like to see how the story continues. I was extremely excited and in ecstasy when I read this, but then later in the week, I read some disturbing news from Sci-Fi. What is this news, you might ask, that could bring me down? Well, Sci-Fi, in its infinite wisdom, has decided that at mid-season of both Stargate SG-1 and Stargate Atlantis, mainly at the end of summer, they will take a break to air different original programming, such as Battlestar Galactica and Eureka. When Battlestar Galactica ends its uninterrupted run of 20 shows in March, then SG-1 and Atlantis will continue. I hate it when Sci-Fi does this. They do it every year, because I don't know why they do it, but Sci-Fi is the only network that does this. Sky One in the UK, and Canada, I believe, both give both shows full runs without a break. If Sci-Fi wants to continue to lose viewers, then by all means they should continue this strategy. But I wonder if they realize the popularity of downloading the shows, when the shows are both aired on UK and Canadian networks, people burn them or rip them from the airwaves, and then populate the internet with them, and thus U.S. fans can download them and not fall behind. This then causes Sci-Fi to lose viewers later on in the season, because some fans have already seen the show and won't tune in to see what they have already seen, but is being proposedly declared as new in the U.S. Now, I don't promote this behavior at all, because ultimately the continuation of both shows depends on U.S. viewers, and so I watch them diligently, both on Friday nights when they are aired. But I'm rather disappointed when I have to wait to finish it, and it just seems to take forever. And now that it's going to be until March, it's just going to seem longer. It just angers me. Why can't they just give them a run uninterrupted? But anyway, that's my rant for the day. Now for some lighter news. It turns out that three cast members from Stargate Atlantis, and one relation to a cast member, will be starring in an independent film by David Hewlett called A Dog's Breakfast. The cast members are, of course, David Hewlett, Paul McGillion, Leighton Rochelle, and David's sister, Kate Hewlett. You can watch the preview on YouTube by following the links from gateworld.net. From the preview, it looks kind of funny, but I would just like to point out that I noticed that the corridors on the ship on the fake movie that they're watching look a lot like the corridors on the Daedalus or the Odyssey. Just a little detail I picked up on. Maybe you guys picked up on it too. Or I'm just imagining things. There's not much known on the movie right now. I didn't do an internet search because I was trying to record the show, but I'm sure more information will be released, and I will talk about it here on the podcast. So stay tuned for more details. Now, if you don't already know this, this news was provided by GateRoll.net, your best online resource for all things, for all Stargate knowledge. Go check them out. I'm sure they would greatly appreciate it. That's all for news. Back to you.
Previously on Stargate Atlantis.
The second episode of Season 3 of Stargate Atlantis, entitled Misbegotten, picks up where the season opener left off. Dr. Weir is still on Earth, and a hive ship is on its way to Atlantis. But lo and behold, the hive ship arrives, and it's not crewed by Wraith, but rather by Atlantis personnel. And it turns out that it's the hive ship that the crew of the Daedalus captured back in Episode 1. Now, even though we have a hive ship, it has problems. It's been severely damaged, and power supply is not near to full capacity, and it doesn't have enough power to both fight and keep the converted Wraith in stasis. So a decision is made to take the Wraith to an uninhabited planet that does not have a Stargate or hold human life. And on this planet, stuff hits the fan. Dr. Beckett's retrovirus does work, but in order to keep the converted Wraith docile, the drug needs to be administered daily. The original plan was to just dump them off, teach them how to treat themselves, and then leave. But because Dr. Beckett the doctor, he has to uphold the Hippocratic Oath, and thus do no harm and help people whenever possible. So he decides to stay behind to continue his research into keeping the Wraith converted on a more permanent basis. But his plan backfires when the converts revolt and take over the camp. Their plan is to escape, but how? Apparently, when a bunch of Wraith get together, they can extend the range of their telepathic abilities and thus contact more Wraith and call for help. This is really bad news for Atlantis, but there is good news. Not all Wraith convert or revert back at the same pace. So that's kind of a good thing. So it does work on some people and not on others. That's one thing that we learned. And other things that we learned, hive ships can detect when Wraith are around and become active, similar to the way ancient technology interacts with ancients or humans who have the ancient gene. Because of this, it is rather hard to interface with Wraith technology if a Wraith isn't around. So it's really quite a miracle they got the minimal functionality that they did out of the hive. So in short, and to sum it up really quickly, and let his command, lost a hive ship, and very possibly let Wraith get away, who know of Atlantis. You know, but what kind of show would we have if Atlantis wasn't always under constant threat? So that's basically the rundown. So if you want, if you want to go see it, you know what to do. Now I'm going to move into what I like about the episode and what I didn't like. Since I had, you know, just one or two more dislikes than likes, I'll start with them. Dislikes. Again, Atlantis Command decides to trust a Wraith, mainly Michael. But, you know, it turns out to backfire. So, they didn't learn the lesson the first time, why should they learn it now? Hopefully, though, they will. Another dislike is the inability to keep ships that they find. You know, they lost the Orion not long after getting it. Granted, the Orion did actually go out in a blaze of glory and destroy one hive ship, but it would have been so much cooler if they had an ancient battleship at their disposal. They lose Orion, but they do gain a hive. But then they lose the hive. And the sucky thing about losing the hive is, it didn't even do much good. Besides, didn't do much good. I mean, it did good, but not a whole lot. The only thing we can hope is that the orbital attack destroyed the Wraith on the planet. My last dislike for this episode is the International Oversight Advisory's continued disturbance of Atlantis Command. But it actually ties into some of my likes, so we'll get to those now. My likes for this episode is that they gain more understanding of how a hive ship operates and the power distribution of ship. And as many of you may know, knowledge is power, so the more you know, the more powerful you get. Basically, what happened in this episode is I learned quite a bit from a hive ship. Secondly, is Dr. Beckett improved his retrovirus and was continuing to work on a more permanent solution, but the research had to be suspended because he doesn't have any Wraith to study anymore. And the last like of this episode is Mr. Woosley of the IOA. This man is very conniving, and he basically does what he wants, when he wants to, and goes about his way however he wants to go about it, making him seem kind of like a jerk. But he does have a good sense of judgment. He does lie to do the right thing, and he does this in order to keep command structure of Atlantis in place. I really like this little man. He knows how to work politics. But the way he does it just makes you love to hate him. And with that little bit on Mr. Woosley, I have finished the episode part of this fan cast. So, I hope you enjoyed it, and stay tuned for next week.
Oh, she feels hungry too?
Genius, Rodney.
True, but I didn't do it.
Alright, so we got news out of the way, and we got the episode out of the way. So what else are we going to talk about? Oh, yeah, that's right, Dr. McKay. Yes, him. The arch-nemesis of Lieutenant Colonel Carter at the SGC. But now that he's on Atlantis, she doesn't have to worry too much about him. Which is a good thing. But what are we going to talk about concerning Dr. McKay? Well, for starters, he's smart. Not as smart as Sam, but still pretty smart. For instance, has he destroyed a sun? No. But he did destroy a planet, albeit on accident. Either way, Dr. McKay is now the smartest man on Atlantis, and has saved the city and its inhabitants on numerous occasions. Not only that, but he also knows ancient and can decipher their language. But we already know what he can do. Let's talk about the person behind the genius. For starters, he's Canadian, so he's got that going for him. Secondly, as stated before, he's a genius. And thirdly, he doesn't like to place his trust in other people very often. This last point has been pointed out in numerous episodes in season 2. The first episode this showed up was in Duet. That's the episode where Dr. McKay has Cadman stuck in his mind, because they were both stuck in a Wraith, whatever, dematerializer thing. And he doesn't trust Dr. Zelenka enough to get him out of the mess. Not only that, but when Cadman is in his mind, he doesn't trust her advice that she gives him on girls, nor does he trust her with control over his body. The second episode that showed his lack of trust in others appears in Grace Under Pressure. This episode places Rodney in a downed jumper, sinking into the oceans of the planet that Atlantis is on. His mistrust is evident in his lack of ability to take the safe road and conserve the power of the jumper in the hope that he can survive long enough for them to mount a rescue. Instead, he proceeds with a risky plan that ends in him nearly destroying the puddle jumper. Luckily, though, he is saved, and because the others were able to come up with a rescue plan that worked, and hopefully this earned his trust in them. Next part is his Canadian heritage, which gives him the distinction of pronouncing Z's as Zed's, which is where we get ZPM from. I rather like ZPM instead of ZPM. It just sounds cooler. Other than that, we don't really know too much else about McKay besides that he has a sister and a cat, but he left them behind to go to Atlantis. I read that there is actually an episode with McKay and his sister coming up in season 3, so stay tuned for that. This should be rather interesting. Now we get into the genius of McKay. Yes, we know he's a regular genius with the ideas he comes up with. For instance, using the superconductive material of the city to channel the raw energy of lightning in order to power the shields. And then, well, he had help with Zelenka on that one, but he also had help with Zelenka using the cloak, cloaking technology and the puddle jumpers to cloak the city. You know, so, I mean, you know, not everyday people can come up with and actually implement this plan. So, that's good for him. But those are just a few ideas he has come up with. I'm sure there's numerous in the whole 40 episodes that there have been so far of Atlantis, but I'm kind of at a loss right now to talk about them. But Rodney truly shines when he is under pressure. Refer to the aforementioned ideas. He came up with those under pressure. His true brilliance comes when he tries to repair technology when faced with death. A perfect example is how he repaired the hyperdrives on the Orion in order to save them from the cataclysmic explosion from the supervolcano in, I believe, episode 19? No, 18. 18 of season 2. So, I mean, they just showcase him left and right on his brilliance. So, when Rodney was on SG-1, I didn't really like him. He was arrogant and he didn't really care for a whole lot of people. But now that he's on Atlantis, they're trying to soften him up. Granted, he's still arrogant, but his bravery has more than made up for that. So I say let's keep McKay around for a while longer. And that just about finishes my discussion on McKay. So I hope you enjoyed it, and now we're going to move on to technology.
We couldn't hit the side of a barn.
I've shipped 100 times
bigger. Giant flying barn. We couldn't hit that.
What about hitting a stationary target?
All motion in space is relative.
Talking about on the planet.
Well, that I might be able to do.
This week's technology discussion is going to be much shorter than last week's, since it's only covering a small technology. What is this technology, you might ask, that is so small? Well, I'm not one to keep you waiting, so this week's technology discussion is going to cover handheld weapons in the Pegasus Galaxy. I really only know of one handheld weapon, and that is the Wraith Stunner. I say one because it originated in the Pegasus Galaxy, whereas the guns the team brought over all came from Milky Way Galaxy. So the Wraith Stunners. They're quite effective against humans and Wraith alike. More so against humans than the Wraith because it was designed to take out human-like creatures. The stunners are similar to Zat guns in that they incapacitate on one shot, except they're bigger and bulkier and harder to carry around. Not much is really known about the stunners, so I don't really have too much to say about them. But I wanted to talk about this because I wanted to bring up this point. Where are the ancient handheld weapons? Think about it for a second. The ancients were in a centuries-long war with the Wraith, and they had to engage them on numerous occasions, on planets and space, and it just seems logical that they'd have to engage them in hand-to-hand combat, or something very similar. I guess, though, since the ancients were studying ascension, that at some point during their path, they would have gained some superhuman powers like telekinesis or telepathic abilities that would have, that they could have implemented against them. But before that, what would they have used? I think there's some technology lying out there that they have yet to discover in the city, and I believe it would be rather amazing for Atlantis Command to find some and then put them to good use. You know, on that note, we already have stunners that work effectively, and that's the Zat guns, so why don't we borrow some from the SGC and bring them over? Since the Gould are no longer a threat, I'm sure they can get their hands on, some from the Jaffa or, other people, since they were able to steal them. So, with the idea of Zat guns being brought over, I gotta pose this question. How do Zat guns work against the Wraith? Would the same rule that applies to humans apply to the Wraith? That, in case many of you are wondering what the rule is, the rule is one shot stuns, two shots kill, and three shots disintegrate them. Now, it's hard to say how effective they'll be against the Wraith. I think it'd be kind of cool to test them out, so maybe we'll find out in the future. That's all I really have to say for technology. I rather enjoyed it, and I hope you did too.
You see, in my business, sometimes it's more important not to let inconvenient facts get in the way of the greater truth. And the truth is, you should remain here, in charge of this expedition.
Well, that's about all the show I have for you this week. So I hope you enjoyed it. If you have any questions you would like me to answer about myself, or about the show, you can email me at sgfancast@gmail.com. On similar lines, if you listeners have any questions, comments, or rants about this show or Stargate, either SG-1 or Atlantis, you'd like to share with me, or you'd like to share your knowledge of the shows with me, you know where to email me to. I don't even know why I put the email in there. It doesn't seem like anybody even emails me. Whatever. Anyway, I'm done. That's all I gotta say. Stay tuned for next week, because there should be 3 episodes. Maybe. It's not set in stone. But there should be 3. 1 by me and 2 by Leon. Hopefully. Maybe. Anyway. So, Stargate fans, until next time, I'm going through the gate.